Welcome to the East County Magazine live radio show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio representing the public interest, not special interest. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso on KNSJ 89.1 FM, your host, Miriam Raftery.
Here's a preview of the lineup for today's show. With controversy swirling around Mayor Bob Filner, today we're talking with Lori Saldana, former assemblywoman and congressional candidate who has some insights into the controversy. She says she tried to warn party leaders about allegations that multiple women complained of unwanted advances made by then-Congressman Filner. She has also taught a course titled Sex, Power, and Politics, and she shares her insights into the differences between men and women in politics and why so many powerful men seem to be behaving so badly. Rebecca Williamson will be interviewing Rudy Reyes, a burn victim and hero of the Cedar Fire, who is now cooking up a hot new career path after appearing on a reality TV show. In Green Scene, we'll be telling you about a new energy alternative, bladeless wind turbines. Given that a blade recently fell off a wind turbine out here in Ocotillo, weighing several tons, this is a very timely story. Ariel Brook brings you this week's top festivals and family fun events in her destination East County. Plus, we'll replay last week's interview with Congresswoman Susan Davis about her new bill that seeks to bring accountability to a secretive government agency that has been killing thousands of animals here in San Diego County. Bookshelf host Raina Menashe will interview acclaimed horror novelist Mark Clement, who is MC of this year's San Diego Book Awards. Connie Beck brings you summertime tips for mulching your garden, while Janice Mork interviews the founder of Ember Arts, a fair trade business in East County that has helped lift women a world away out of poverty. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. I'm here today with Lori Saldana, former assemblywoman, former congressional candidate, and a strong progressive voice in local Democratic politics. And she is also the former instructor of a course at San Diego State titled
Sex, Power, and Politics.
Sex, Power, and Politics. Well, it turns out that this is very germane to our topic today, which is the controversy involving Mayor Bob Filner. Now, last week, three supporters of the mayor, former supporters, strong progressive voices, including Donna Frye, have come forward and called for the mayor to resign because of what they consider to be credible allegations of sexual harassment by multiple women who worked for the mayor in City Hall. Now, we should say that these allegations are vague, and we don't know the exact nature of them as of this taping of the alleged harassment. However, the mayor himself has come forward and admitted that he has done some inappropriate things, that he was intimidating towards some of these women, and that he was disrespectful of some of the members of his staff who were female. We're going to play you a clip of the mayor's statement.
I begin today by apologizing to you. I have diminished the office to which you elected me. The charges made at today's news conference are serious. When a friend like Donna Frye is compelled to call for my resignation, I'm clearly doing something wrong. And I've reached into my heart and soul and realized I must and will change my behavior. As someone who has spent a lifetime fighting for equality for all people, I am embarrassed to admit that I have failed to fully respect the women who work for me and with me, and that at times I have intimidated them. It's a good thing that behavior that would have been tolerated in the past is being called out in this generation for what it is, inappropriate and wrong. I am also humbled to admit that I need help. I have begun to work with professionals to make changes in my behavior and approach. In addition, my staff and I will participate in sexual harassment training provided by the city. Please know that I fully understand that only I am the one that can make these changes. If my behavior doesn't change, I cannot succeed in leading our city. In the next few days, I will be reaching out to those who now work in the mayor's office or have previously worked for me, both men and women, to personally apologize for my behavior. I will also be announcing fundamental changes within the mayor's office designed to promote a new spirit of cooperation, respect, and effectiveness. You have every right to be disappointed in me. I only ask that you give me an opportunity to prove I am capable of change so that the vision I have for our city's future can be realized.
One day after that tape was made, Mayor Filner said that he would support an independent investigation of the charges against himself and that he believes such investigation will prove him innocent of any criminal wrongdoing. Now, Lori, you have some insights into this whole story. I understand that you came forward when he was first planning to run for mayor with some concerns that you had heard from women.
I was actually preparing to teach the course at San Diego State on sex, power, and politics. I was in conversations with many women about my upcoming campaign for Congress, and I began to hear, as we discussed other elections that were coming up in the next year, a series of stories that all traced back to then U.S. Representative Bob Filner.
And we should make clear that you were not running in the same congressional district, so there's no political conflict or anything here.
I was running in the 52nd district, which was then held by Brian Bilbray. So when I began to see this pattern of stories about Bob, and I want to make it clear, these women were not complaining. They were simply telling me of incidents where Bob had been very pushy in his advances towards them, despite their telling him they weren't available. In some cases, they were married. They were not interested in dating him or seeing him socially. Incidents where he was very inappropriate.
You mentioned something about a closet.
There was one, an educator who was giving him a tour of the facilities, and he somehow got alone with her in a closet area away from the other people on the tour, and she was very uncomfortable by this. And so I think that the combination of different women telling me very similar anecdotes, and I want to make it clear, this was not illegal behavior.
I was just going to ask that.
These were not women who worked in his office. These were adult women, professional women, and their response to him was, you know, back off. This is not appropriate. So what they told me did not rise to the level of an investigation, like a law enforcement investigation.
Right.
What they told me was simply that something that I thought needed to be addressed within our Democratic Party circles, because here we are looking at Bob then as the only Democrat to run for mayor of San Diego.
What response did you get when you brought this forward to the party leadership?
I don't think that my concerns were taken seriously by then Chairman Jess Durfee. He was very guarded in his response to my conversation with him that this could escalate and become a problem going forward if it wasn't dealt with soon. He told me that he would set up a meeting with the congressman. Several weeks later, when I talked to him, he said that he had not heard from anyone. I mean, I don't know how these people would have known to contact him. I didn't tell people I was having the conversation with the chairman. But because I was the only one who was making this complaint, and Bob assured him that he had never had any complaints filed against him, they thought it was a non-issue and that there was nothing, basically move on, nothing to see here.
Is that a common scenario when women come forward to complain about harassment or unwanted advances, and make clear that the ones you knew about were not in the workplace, but is that a common reaction that women are not taken seriously when they complain about these things?
I think it varies by situation. I think in a social setting, again, which these were, it's one thing. In a workforce setting, it's taken very seriously because of lawsuits, it's taken so seriously that when I was in the legislature, every 2 years, every new session, we would have to do compulsory sexual harassment training. And I assume that most elected officials go through similar training.
So and yet we still see examples of, typically it's men who have engaged in a pattern of behavior through the years. Arnold Schwarzenegger certainly comes to mind, where there were many, many, many people who talked about even groping in his case, and yet remained in power, and really nothing was done. It was kind of a wink, wink, nod, nod sort of situation.
Often it is said that women enter politics and elected office because they see it as a public service. And you look at their legislative history, and the legislation that they introduce is often really based on serving their constituents. The other theory is that men often go into elected office because it is about power. And just as in the course I taught about sex, power, and politics, men in power tend to act differently and use their political power in different ways. And sometimes that spills over into their interactions outside of their political office and their interactions with people in other venues.
Now, Mayor Filner has apologized, and he has said that he realizes that he needs help. I'm not clear exactly what that means, if he's going for some kind of counseling, presumably. In your experience, or what you've learned through your course, can men change this behavior if they're sufficiently motivated? Can counseling do the job?
It depends on what's at stake for them if they don't do that. I mean, it's like changing any behavior, any bad habits. What's at stake if the behavior doesn't change? Let's go back to the Tiger Woods analogy. What was at stake for him was his livelihood.
Yeah, you've called this the Tiger Woods defense.
Right, that I behave badly, I apologize for the people I hurt, I'm going to get help, I'm going to improve and change my behavior and move forward. And then in his case, he went into counseling and private rehab.
As did Bill Clinton after the Monica Lewinsky scandal in order to save his marriage. That was
exactly
what he did. And
in the
case we
of
haven't
Anthony,
heard about him in the news since then. In
the case of Anthony Weiner, he resigned his office. And he also went to counseling because he wanted to protect his marriage and his new family. And look at Eliot Spitzer. He resigned from office, and now he's back running for office again. So I think the American public has a great tolerance for people who admit their mistakes and want to move on.
So you think that Mayor Filner potentially could salvage his political career?
What's at stake for him? That's the question. Because if his livelihood is at stake, I think, just as with these other people, that he has a great incentive and motivation to take the steps he needs to change his behavior.
Livelihood and also his ideals for all of his...
Well, his effectiveness and his ability to do his job as a leader in San Diego. So if these things are perceived as at stake, both his job, his mm-hmm. elected position, and his ability to do his job well as a leader.
Now, it's interesting that the day before he made his admission that the new chair of the San Diego Democratic Party, which is now Francine Busby, a woman, Francine was not giving him a pass. She was basically saying that we need to hear from the mayor. We need some mm-hmm. explanation for this. We need some details. And then he came out with this statement.
And I have encouraged through other people, I've encouraged the current Democratic Party chairwoman to organize a meeting with Democratic women leaders in San Diego with Mayor Filner and get some assurances. I've also encouraged my women in the women's community. What I have done is I have contacted a lot of people that I've met through my years in public service and mm-hmm. as a community activist in San Diego, and I've said, you need to sit down and hold him accountable and come up with a list of things that you expect from him. I mean, that is the way that you hold someone accountable to change their behavior. Mm-hmm. Does he have a task force on women's issues? Is he going to be looking at ways not only to improve his personal behavior, but think of the women who are not willing to come forward? I don't want this type of behavior to be considered normal by anyone mm-hmm. in any situation. Some of it is generational. I think older women are more accustomed to dealing with men who have these kinds of antiquated ideas that go back to Mad Men era. I think younger women are more distraught when they encounter men like what's alleged that the mayor has done, because they may have less experience with that, because there have been more efforts to educate young people about proper behavior, treating one another with respect, mm-hmm. not doing the types of either verbal or physical harassment that I was hearing when I was talking with women 2 years ago.
Right. From the party standpoint, they must be a little bit torn on this, because on the one hand, this is the party that says that they stand up for equality for all people, and they certainly have backed the mayor's progressive vision for San Diego of doing things to help the homeless and get into some of these neighborhoods that never get city funding and go make sure that everyone has a voice and everyone has some representation in City Hall.
And then it becomes a question of is he effective in carrying out those progressive platforms if he's hindered by the public perception of his personal failings. So that's the balancing act that he has to go through now. And I think he's received some good coaching on how to move forward by releasing the DVD and apologizing without any specific details. So I think he is making efforts to be able to continue, but will he be effective going forward? It just depends. What else will come out? I mean, it seems like this was a very bad week for him. So moving forward, what other stories may come out?
Now, you've said earlier when we were chatting before we went on air that there is sometimes a double standard for men and for women in politics.
You know, it's often said, Henry Kissinger most famously said, that power is the most effective aphrodisiac. And so powerful men are very attractive. And powerful women, on the other hand, you know, we used to joke about it up in Sacramento when I was part of the leadership team with Karen Bass, the first Democrat elected woman speaker in California history. You know, a lot of men are very intimidated by powerful women, whereas a lot of women are very attracted to powerful men. So there is this dynamic.
Interesting. Very interesting.
That I think you see people still not sure, you know, how to interact with women in power. I think maybe some of the disappointment that people are expressing is that people do look up with respect and admiration to powerful people. And when you see that they have feet of clay, when they do behave badly in their personal lives, I think it is both disappointing and undermining to their ability to continue to be in positions of leadership.
I believe you've been involved in efforts to get more women involved in politics and encourage them to run for office.
I certainly work with women who want to make a difference for their community. I've gone beyond thinking it can only be an elected office, although I do think we would have better budgets, we would have better policies, that there are a lot of things that would improve if we had a better balance. The United States is out of 140 or 170 nations with elected governments, we rank somewhere around 70th in terms of the number of women we have elected nationally.
Amazing.
Yes, it's amazing what other countries excel way beyond us.
Are there resources out there or organizations specifically for women who are looking to run for public office, Lori?
But what I would really encourage women who want to make a difference to do, though, is before they go and run for elected office, is volunteer in their communities and get a sense of what it means to serve on boards, to serve on commissions, get to know the community. I hate to see the model of I'll go and work in somebody's elected office and then I'll follow in their footsteps without ever having done something as sort of a service before going right into professional politics. I think that there's a disconnection between the needs of a lot of people.
Surprisingly, that since you've left office, that the number of women, the percentage of women in the state legislature has actually fallen sharply. Do you have that figure?
Part of that has to do with the cost of campaigning. I was very struck when I run my first campaign, it was a very grassroots effort. I think increasingly you're seeing people who can afford to serve in office. Remember, we've also seen a decline in salaries to elected officials. So the people that you're seeing run for office, they have left other careers and they're on a pension. And they serve in elected office because they have other income. They're married to a wealthy spouse. So increasingly, my concern is that we're seeing elected office being held by people who basically are independently wealthy, and they can afford to serve because they're not counting on doing that as their only income. And what you see then are people who are often more concerned about investments, about tax codes that favor the wealthy. You just look at what's happening at the federal level, and you see that there's a very disproportionate number of people who are millionaires serving in Washington.
But what is the answer to that?
I think we need public financing for elections. I think we need to limit how much personal wealth people can put into their own campaigns. I think we need to change the FCC to allow equal time. So if one candidate who's very wealthy can pay for their own ads on television, you allow, these are the public's airwaves, you should allow other candidates to have some type of equal time available to them. So there's a variety of ways that we need. Campaign really is a marketing effort, and the money that goes into it is to get out the information, both mailers, broadcast. You know, the sideshow to this potential of having a recall and a special election for mayor is that the people that make money off of these elections would love the opportunity to do that because there is so much money involved with campaign cycles.
Right. Well, it's certainly here on the East County Magazine show, we're on public radio, KNSJ. We certainly, when we get into campaign season, will be committed to interviewing all candidates, all voices, and helping to make sure that our listeners don't just hear from the most wealthy and the most powerful candidates out there.
Well, and that's why I like to support public radio and make sure that all voices are heard, not just those who can buy the airtime.
Well, Lori, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the show today, East County Magazine Radio Show. You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. We have an exciting and interesting lineup for you this week at Destination East County with music, cars, movies, and a few unique events. On Tuesday, June 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Lemon Grove Library, delight in the singing of Erica Davies. Erica sings her own originals and standards of composers such as Burt Bacharach. This series is sponsored by the San Diego County Library System, and it is free. Also, in beautiful Lemon Grove, a free Concerts in the Park series is sponsored by the City of Lemon Grove. Outdoor music will be playing from 6:30 to 8 p.m. every Thursday night in Berry Street Park at 7071 Mount Vernon. Lemon Grove invites you to bring a picnic dinner and listen to a different kind of music each week. The great rock and roll group, Left for Dead, will perform its infinitely danceable repertoire this Thursday, July 18th. Back up to Wednesday night, July 17th, and it's back to downtown El Cajon at Magnolia and Main for their famous Cajon Classic Cruises, with more than 200 specialty classic and unique cars from 5 to 8 p.m., featuring a weekly theme. Visitors can view the best theme cars, enjoy dinner and drink specials from local restaurants, play in the bounce house, the kids, that is, and enjoy street vendors peddling delights, including kettle corn and hot dogs. You're not done with classic cars yet, though, because La Mesa celebrates their Back to the 50s every Thursday night on La Mesa Boulevard in the Village of La Mesa, with live bands and shops open for your enjoyment. Prizes are given for the best vehicles. On Thursday, July 18th, from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m., the City of Santee and Barona Summer Concerts presents their Blues and Barbecue. The Mercedes Moore Band and the Bill McGee Blues Band will be burning down the blues for you. Bring a blanket or beach chair and enjoy your own picnic or Phil's Barbecue. The beer garden features Manzanita Brewing Company. Located at the Town Center Community Park East in Santee, Save Mission Trails will also have a table and free dessert at this Thursday's Santee Summer Concert. Nutshell Promotions presents the July Ramona Valley Wine Experience. On July 20th and 21st, from 10 a.m. to sunset, Nutshell Promotions invites wine lovers to discover, explore, and enjoy Ramona with the second Ramona Valley Wine Experience Wine Shuttle. Enjoy country roads, local wildlife, gorgeous weather, award-winning wineries, and meet the friendly people of Ramona. There are two restaurants along the shuttle route, so travelers can grab a bite to eat. Folks can take in some home cooking, or for those who prefer to wine and dine with a picnic, facilities are available at each winery, but passengers must bring their own food. Tickets are available by going to www.RamonaValleyWineExperience.com. Each day is limited to just 200 shuttle riders. One of East County's treasures, Mission Trails Regional Park, is having a special interpretive twilight walk that is planned for Saturday, July 20th. Meet at the parking lot on the corner of Bushy Hill Drive and Father Junipero Serra Trail across from the Kumeyaay Lake Campground. Bring a flashlight and an extra layer of clothing. Get ready to walk at 7:15 p.m. for 1.5 hours of enjoying nature through the experience of twilight in the park. There will be another twilight hike at Mission Trails in August and one in September. Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation also has a live concert series once a month through December on the third Sunday of each month, and we'll tell you about that in just a minute. Grossmont Center in the Macy's Courtyard Sunset Summer Concert Series is free every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. Weekly raffles and kids' crafts are included. Get down with the blues on July 19th with the Bill McGee Blues Band. Now it's movie time. Get the kids ready and get out the popcorn. First, we go to Lakeside. The movie Wreck-It Ralph will delight kids of all ages on July 19th under the stars at Lindo Lake Park in Lakeside starting at dusk. Or come out on Friday night with the family to Santee Movies by the Lake. July 19th, Movies by the Lake will also feature Wreck-It Ralph with kids' activities beforehand. They have barbecue grills, playgrounds, and of course those beautiful lakes. A snack shack is also available for your munching pleasure. And before the movie, those fun activities for kids abound with hula hoop and water balloon contests and more. Movies at the lake are every other Friday night during the summer at Santee Lakes. Next up, a Mexican fiesta party to celebrate the vintage 1924 Cadillac Julian stage bus that will be held on Saturday, July 20th, 2013, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Motor Transport Museum in Campo. The Mexican fiesta party celebrates the completion of restoration work on the vintage 1924 Cadillac Julian stage bus. Attendees will enjoy a ride in the Cadillac, learn what the state-of-the-art manufacturing of buses was in 1920s, wear vintage clothing, and enjoy vintage music, and there will also be surprise events for the kids. You must RSVP for this event. Now, back to Mission Trails Regional Park. Sunday night, July 21st, from 3 to 4 p.m., at the Visitor's Center Theater, freestyle guitarist James Earp will wow the crowd with his award-winning fingerstyle playing to music as diverse as British folk and California freestyle. A reception immediately follows the performance. And don't forget Sundays at 6 concerts in La Mesa, every Sunday at 6 p.m. at the 360-seat Harry Griffin Park Amphitheater. Bring a cushion and a picnic basket and enjoy some of San Diego's local music talent as they play jazz, country, concert band, and more each Sunday evening. KNSJ invites you to the station's launch party August 3rd at Mission Trails Regional Park. Plus, East County Magazine and KNSJ will be hosting a barbecue and Wild West Fest August 10th at the Descanso Town Hall. You can find details on these events and more on our calendar of events and in our festivals section at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Send information on your major events to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Have a great week, and we'll see you around East County.
Attention, Earthlings. Comic-Con International starts July 18th. If you are planning on attending, be aware that parking downtown fills up and is difficult to find during the event. The Metropolitan Transit System will have enhanced trolley service for the Green Line starting on Wednesday preview night. The Green Line, which serves many East County communities, will take you directly to the station in front of the convention center. The Orange Line will also operate on an extended schedule during the event, and you can transfer to the Green Line at the Grossmont Center Transit Station or the Santa Fe Train Depot. Day passes provide unlimited rides on all trolley lines and most MTS bus routes as well. If you choose to buy day passes, you will need an MTS card. MTS will release commemorative Comic-Con 2-day, 3-day, 4-day, and 5-day passes at ticket booths at select trolley stations or the transit store in downtown San Diego. Most importantly, have a great time at Comic-Con.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Sierra Robinson, bringing you a special report on new technologies in wind energy. Wind turbines have raised safety concerns locally after a multi-ton blade fell off a wind turbine in Ocotillo. In Campo, industrial wind turbines blew apart in a storm, hurling heavy blade debris. Such accidents pose risks when large turbines are located near homes, roads, and parks. Turbine blades also pose a danger to birds and bats. Plus, neighbors of large wind turbines have complained about the whooshing sound of blades as well as annoying shadow flicker. But now, some manufacturers are testing out a new generation of bladeless wind turbines. These designs hold promise to potentially reduce risks to wildlife and also eliminate some, though not all, of the problems for people living near turbines. Bladeless turbines may be smaller in scale, lessening impacts on views and potentially reducing noise. For example, Shearwind's bladeless, funnel-shaped wind turbine, called Invalex, channels wind through a narrow passage that the company claims will produce more energy than a standard turbine, and that it can do so with lower wind speeds. That means the bladeless turbines could be used in urban areas, sparing natural habitats from destruction. Safon Energy, a Tunisian company, also boasts a bladeless turbine, which converts wind power to energy through back-and-forth motion using pistons. The Safonian model is also designed to store excess energy, providing power for times when the wind does not blow.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, serving San Diego and East County, and streaming live worldwide on knsj.org.
Coming up next, it's the Offbeat Report, with Rebecca Williamson traveling off the beaten track to find some fascinating stories from the offbeat to the upbeat.
This is Rebecca Williamson here with East County Magazine, and I'm interviewing Rudy Reyes, who has a variety of accomplishments to his credit, one of which is he's a survivor of the Cedar Fire, and he survived over 70% burns on his body. Can you explain a little bit about the experience you had with the fires?
I'm in the Smithsonian, recognized as one of the worst injured, the hero of the 2003 San Diego fires. Because of that, I've toured and spoken and tried to help a lot of people, and I've become more of an advocate to give back. Because, again, I survived one of the biggest fires in human history.
And then another thing that you also do is you're an advocate for the disabled. Can you explain more on what you've done there?
I've gone through on the disabled level and tried to help people understand that, look, just because I have physical issues doesn't mean my life is over, right? So I've tried to make other people understand that if they see me on TV and they see me doing good things, they can too.
But you're cooking up something else different now. You appeared on the MasterChef TV show. Can you go into a little bit about how you actually were inspired to do it and the whole procedure, the whole timeline of how it happened?
Speaking on the disability level and the inspiration, well, let's be honest, the last winner was a blind lady. And that inspired me to say, hey, look, if she can do something, I can do something. So when I saw them advertising here in San Diego saying that we're going to come to San Diego and do auditions, I'm going to jump in and see what I can do. So I went online and put in the application and for the most part kind of forgot about it. And then the week before the audition, they called me up and they said that we saw your application and we'd like to see what you can do and we'd like to see you come in. We understand that you have burn issues, so we're going to give you VIP access. Well, there I am with VIP access and I don't know what I'm going to cook for these people. So I'm figuring I'm a rarity. Let's cook them a rarity. And I know how to do Indian tacos, Native American tacos, Indian fry bread.
Rudy, if you could explain a little bit more about your own ethnic background.
Honestly, I like to call myself indigenous. I'm from here. I'm a mix of Mexican and local Kumeyaay Indians. I'm from the Brona Band of Native American Indians. And that makes me as indigenous as you can get. I've got degrees in archaeology. That's my background. I used to get extra credit in college for teaching kids how to make fry bread. So I went ahead and made fry bread and got it to the audition within a half hour. So it was still warm and fresh because I had VIP access. So when I got there and presented my dish, oh, they loved it. They had other judges coming in to try it out because it was such a rarity they'd never had this. Next part audition is we line up the people that made it through the first one and get your story. Well, as you can tell, I've got a compelling story. In the personal interview, they ask you more personal questions. Why are you doing this? What are you doing it for? And for me, it wasn't about me. It was about the other people out there to see me and to understand that just because, you know, yeah, I'm burned. Yeah, I'm missing fingers. Yeah, my fingers are fused. They don't move the way they used to. But I can still cook and I can still do and I can still make a quality life. And that's what it was about.
And explain a little bit about your products that you brought and also the recipe, if you would share that.
You want me to give away my recipes?
I do.
Okay. So, again, in making a Native American taco, you got to make the fry bread first. I made the fry bread with, let's say, 2 cups of flour, half a spoonful or a tablespoonful of salt, a little bit of water, a little bit of milk, and you mix that all together. Don't forget some oil, just about a teaspoon of oil, and you mix that all together until it makes a nice dough. And then that dough you flatten out into basically a tortilla. You get some corn oil nice and hot, and you fry it up till it becomes a big poofy bread, right? And then that gets set aside. The meat consisted, for me at least on the show, of buffalo meat. I was lucky in the fact that I sourced it out and they had it for me available. Unfortunately, buffalo meat isn't exactly fatty, so it didn't keep its rendering well when it went through the actual show. But that's beside the point. Then from there, I made a fresh pico salsa. Now that salsa consisted of chopped tomatoes, garlic, onion, yellow pepper, cut up into it nice and deep. And then lime juice to make it that savory salsa, along with about a spoonful of salt. That, along with a little bit of lettuce, some aged Monterey Jack cheese, and you put together a taco. Just a generalized taco. So now I put down my bread, some beans, because the beans just adds the stickiness so that your meat doesn't fall off the bread. And then you add the salsa, some lettuce, cheese, and now you got a taco, and just fold it up and start eating.
And how much did you have to prepare? Like how many, the quantity of how many tacos that you did at the audition?
At the audition, I made plenty of tacos. Matter of fact, I made so many bread that I was giving them away to other people to try out because they had never tried it at the auditions. I purposely made it like that to be able to give away and be able to have extra. It's a tradition we do. It's a tradition that goes back to Native Americanness that when you do something like this, you give it away.
And then was it also the same with other people who were auditioning? Did you get to sample some of the other people's foods?
A lot of them weren't. And a lot of them were very quiet and hush-hush about their recipes and techniques because they didn't want you to be competitive with them. You know, this is a big competitive, 100 down to 1. Me, I was the exact opposite. I was there to make friends.
Now, you did the actual audition locally in a major hotel.
Right.
And then what happened after that?
They did the first auditions here in San Diego. So they had to go to all the other cities in the United States to do their auditions before they decided. So we're talking another 2.5 months passed before I actually got a confirmation saying, we chose you. They took us up to LA and we stayed in another hotel there. We were sequestered for about 2 weeks while we did the show. I gotta say, thank God I didn't make it much further because I didn't know these TV shows were as hardcore as they are. You get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and you're not done until 9 o'clock at night filming and taping. You're on your feet the whole time. My toes were going white from bad circulation. I'm glad I didn't stay.
Okay, so you go on the show and you hear the music from the show and that's the go.
Now they're going to let me go and let me cook. And then I was free and I knew exactly what I was doing and I was having fun while I was cooking. The real problem I had is we had a short circuit of an oven and an hour and a half passed between when I presented to the judges and when I had cooked. my food, for the most part, wasn't going to work. And I knew that going in. So I decided on the other end to make it a good presentation at the very least and make it about what I had in my background. The judges loved me. Let's be honest, two of them loved my food. The one from New York really didn't, right? And he was just because he's from New York. You kind of expect that. He's got a higher class taste. My food is rustic. We're talking Indian food, right? See,
Gordon Ramsay is legendary. What was it like to meet Gordon Ramsay, and was it intimidating?
Don't be fooled by the gentleman. He's not what he shows in Hell's Kitchen. In Hell's Kitchen, he makes himself a monster on purpose. It's Hell's Kitchen. The show I was on was MasterChef. He's really nice. Got to meet him, talk with him, shake hands. He liked me, right? It's just because of the problem we had, he couldn't let me go through. So he chose to allow me to come back if I so choose. So,
do you swap recipes with Gordon? I mean, do you sort of like pick his brain about, hey, Gordon, you know, what can you give to me?
He was very honest with me and told me he had never mastered a fried bread recipe. It's something he had never gotten down, and he'd like to go spend some time with Native Americans to get it down. Along with that, Graham Elliott, the bigger gentleman, the other of the three chefs, he loved my food, and he invited me to Chicago to go train with him. So in a few months, I'm planning to go to Chicago and spend some time with Graham Elliott and learn from him.
And what other projects have sort of come to the forefront in terms of what you want to introduce in this culinary line to people with the Native American dishes?
Okay, well, that's the idea there. Look it. I come from a background where we have staples. We have certain things that a lot of these other cultures that are right around us have never tried. Like, I'm sure you've never heard of shawi, acorn mush. It's a tradition here in San Diego, and not a lot of people have had it because it's a rarity. I know how to make shawi. It takes a lot of tanning, a lot of effort, but I know how to make it.
And what is in it?
It's acorn, which has been ground down into a fine powder, and then tannin leached from it so it doesn't have any of the acids that are in acorns naturally. And then that you turn into basically a flour or a mush to make a bread with. It's a little sticky, but it is good. Every tradition, every culture has their staples. My plan is in the next year or so, I want to go around to these different cultures and learn their staples. And then bring them back to our society to be able to teach them to others. To try to bring back archaeologically so that we don't lose it culturally.
Now your show, the episode that you were on, aired recently in June.
In June.
Where would you recommend for listeners to go see it again?
You can find it all over the place. It's on YouTube, Hulu, you name it. I'm series 4, episode 2. I was in the first night of the show. So they used me for a teaser, a commercial cliffhanger. I'm well known. I made a lot of fans off of that show. I can't wait to go back. Now every year I go to a gathering of burn survivors. So when I go back there in a few months, I'm about to have fun, get to see all my friends, teach them some new stuff, and be like, hey, look what I did for us. Because for someone like me to get on a show like that and to present is good.
So, you have a recipe, a signature recipe that you've taken to the forefront on
Correct.
TV. Now, when you go to the store, when you go around the community, do you get hit up for the recipe?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've had people see me two aisles down in a row and kind of stalk me for a little bit. And then all of a sudden come up and be like, did I see you on TV? Yeah, you saw me on TV. I'm that guy. Oh, nice to meet you. How'd you do that? What's the recipe of this? I'm like, oh, okay, you want my right here? I'll write it down real quick for you, right? And don't get me wrong, writing it down isn't going to exactly teach you how to make it. So I've got a Vimeo video that I actually have out there where I've taught, where I made the application for MasterChef and I taught them on that show how to make my fry bread. It's available if you look me up on Vimeo.com. Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O. And that site allows for small people to put up their own local videos just to have it up. It's on there so you can learn how to make my empanadas. You can learn how to make my fry bread because the same recipe I make my empanadas is the same recipe I make my fry bread.
Thank you.
No problem.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today we're interviewing local author, editor, and teacher Mark A. Clements. My guest has had 4 novels published and has edited dozens of others. His book, The Land of Nod, won Best Horror or Mystery and the first Theodore Geisel Award at the San Diego Book Awards, where he will be this year's Master of Ceremonies. Mark also teaches at San Diego Writers, Inc., the Southern California Writers Conference, and the La Jolla Writers Conference. He is especially known for his late-night read and critique workshops and his pep talks on perseverance and passion. Welcome, Mark. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Your first book, 602, A Ghost Story, was written on a typewriter and traditionally published in 1989. And now all your books are available as ebooks. How have these changes in the publishing industry affected you as a novelist and teacher?
The truth is they don't affect me at all. An awful lot of people who are beginning writers or even fairly experienced writers who have not been published start to put things backwards. They start to be concerned about, do I go with a conventional publisher? Do I publish this as an ebook? Before they've actually finished the job. To me, the writing of the book itself comes first. You write the book for yourself and for the people around you to make it as perfect as you can. Then you worry about how and where to publish it.
You also teach a class called Poetry for Novelists. With so many industry challenges, how do you keep those literary fires burning?
First of all, I read poetry, which is a fairly recent interest of mine. Also lots of nonfiction and essays, articles, as well as novels and short stories. The idea being to learn everything that you can, which is a never-ending process. Try to find the things that appeal to you and pull from them the things that will inspire your own writing and help you in your own writing. And then worry later about what you're going to do with that work when it's done.
Your books have been categorized as horror, yet you also focus a great deal on character development. Do you still define your work as part of the horror genre? And if so, what does that mean to you?
The genre thing is kind of a pain. Stephen King actually referred to the horror genre as a ghetto at the time when it... Now a lot of bookstores no longer have that genre separated out in a ghetto. They kind of come and go depending on the tastes of the public, of the reading public. But I don't. That's something else I don't concern myself with personally. I write what I want to write. My books were all marketed as horror and had covers that indicated that. But they crossed genres and they had a wide variety of things. One of them was sort of a detective story in a fashion. 602, as you said, was a ghost story. Another would qualify more as a thriller. It always varies, and those are marketing decisions that publishers used to make. Of course, now a lot of authors have to make that kind of choice themselves if they go the self-publishing route. But my good example of how this can be damaging is Michael Crichton. His first book that he published under his own name was called The Andromeda Strain, and by any categorization, it was hard science fiction. But they didn't publish it that way. They didn't market it that way. When it was on the shelves, it was just put in fiction. And we all know what happened with Michael Crichton's career. If he'd been stuck in the science fiction ghetto, the odds of that happening would have been greatly reduced. He would have been considered a science fiction writer. And all of those people out there who say, well, I don't read science fiction, just as there are people who say, I don't read horror, I don't read romance, whatever, would never have picked it up and... history would not have been what it has become in the book world as a result.
Right, and we all love Crichton. What is your next book about, and do you know when it will be available?
It's hard to say when it'll be available. I've been working on it forever. It is a kind of a rumination on evolution in all of its aspects, evolution of individual people, their personalities, their behaviors, evolution of life on Earth, and ways that it might have been different under different circumstances. What if the circumstances were to change and the whole process of evolution of life on Earth were to change? How would the life that's already here deal with it? So again, horror, science fiction, mainstream fiction, what is it? I don't know. All I know is that I'm trying to make it the finest book that I possibly can.
Well, we look forward to reading it. Mark, our time is up, but thank you again for joining us. For more information on Mark A. Clements and his work, please visit his website at www.markaclements.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is East County Magazine's Capital Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. Recently, a Voice of San Diego investigation revealed that a government agency, many of you may have never heard of,
The Wildlife Services arm of the U.S. Department of Agriculture has been killing a very large number of animals with very little oversight of what's really going on. I'm here today with Congresswoman Susan Davis, whose office is looking into this matter and pushing forward some legislation to try to address it. Congresswoman, tell us about the severity of the problem.
Your numbers alone, I think, indicate that there are a number of animals that are being killed every year.
19,000 here in San Diego County alone.
And we want to know more about that, and I think that our constituents would like to know why that is so.
What kind of animals are these?
Well, there are a variety of animals. I mean, some small animals and even, you know, larger animals that can, in some instances, be threatening individuals, but in many of those cases, they are not necessarily threatening, but they may be more of a nuisance mm-hmm. to people, and they may also be killed for sport in a number of circumstances.
We're talking mountain lions, which are protected under California law. If an individual were to go out and shoot one, that would be illegal. They could go to jail and face a huge fine, yeah. And yet this is happening.
A lot of this concern, of course, is that the agency is coming in, and what we want to know is, under what circumstances are these animals being killed? It's another attempt at transparency and giving people an opportunity to look at that information, to look at that data, to understand the circumstances under which that occurred. And I think for the agency as well to be able to do what we kind of call these after-action reports, so they know, was there a attempt to prevent that animal's death?
Right.
What was going on in the interim? What was happening, whether weather-wise or mm-hmm. other kinds of threats to the animal? And why is it that we're seeing these kind of numbers? How do these numbers even compare to other communities and other areas?
Mm-hmm. There's also a whistleblower that came forward, too, who is claiming that he believes the numbers may be 10 times what they're saying, at least in terms of the accidental deaths, because not only is it animals killed on purpose, but also some of them get caught in traps, and some of these are very inhumane ways that these animals are dying, too. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The concerns that we've heard do address the traps that are out there, and we want to know, you know, why are we doing that? Is there a better way? You know, if we do feel that animals are threatening to people who are camping or are in the area.
Mm-hmm. This includes ducks and songbirds and a lot of animals, raccoons, things that don't really seem like they'd be a dire threat to people or livestock for that matter. Now, one of the concerns, as you noted, is that other steps short of lethal force may not be being used when they could be. For example, areas where there's mountain lions, simply suggesting that property owners pen up animals at night in an appropriate shelter. Or I interviewed a cattle rancher out here just a couple weeks ago who'd had lost one animal to mountain lions some years ago. And since then, he got herding dogs. And the herding, simply adding a dog to herd the cattle, will protect them from these predators, and they haven't had any more losses.
That's right. So we're still in the process of accumulating this data and trying to ask these questions. And I certainly call upon my constituents to help us out with that, because we've heard from them that they want us to look into these issues. And that's really the purpose of this legislation. Sometimes legislation can bring about greater clarity in terms of what is the problem that we're trying to address.
And Voice of San Diego has made efforts. They've done a lot of public records acts, and they've been stonewalled on a lot of it. The agency does not seem to want to explain many of these deaths, and they act in secrecy. They are not allowing reporters to go along on any of these kills. It seems that they don't want us, the public, to know what they're mm-hmm. doing, or the press to know what they're doing.
Well, what we'd like to know is, what's the purpose? Why do they find that it is necessary to kill these animals? And are there other choices that can be made about what would happen? And we want to know the information. I think that's what this is all about, more transparency and providing more understanding to the public so that we can move forward and do the best thing on behalf of these animals.
Absolutely. Do we know the number of your bill, and can you tell us just exactly what it would do and what the status is on it? Now, you have a bill, H.R. 2074. Tell us exactly what the bill would do and what the status is on that right now.
This bill would allow the public to be able to access information about the number of animals that are killed in the wild and the circumstances under which they're killed.
Very good. And then presumably if it were found that anything looked inappropriate, then possibly further regulatory action could be taken at that time?
Exactly.
Well, it should be noted that Congresswoman Davis is a very big champion of animal rights, and I believe that you've been recognized before by the Humane Society?
I'm very honored to have been recognized on a number of occasions, actually, by the Humane Society, and will continue to engage the public, really, in this issue and many others that relate to animals.
Well, very good. I'm sure that the wildlife lovers out there across East County appreciate that, and we are very grateful to you for coming on the show today and bringing us the latest from Washington.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I love mulch. Mulch is one of my favorite words because of what it does for us. Here in Southern California, we desperately need mulch. If you've traveled abroad, you've gone to France, you've gone to England, and you've seen that back there, they use something called dust mulch. This is where they go in with a little cultivator and they rake up a little pile of loose soil on the soil surface, and they view that as mulching. And it works for them because it rains about every 30 minutes over there. But we're in Southern California and our sun is hot and it blazes down. First, the definition of mulch is it's anything that you use as a barrier between the sun and the soil. And that's probably the number one wonderful aspect of mulch. It will make your plants much happier. They will grow better because they won't be going through a constant cycle of I'm wet, now I'm hot, now I'm dry, now I'm wet. So the mulch is the blanket that provides a much more serene landscape for your plants. They will be much happier without going through the constant wet, dry, wet, dry, wet, dry cycle. You will also find that it will help your water bill because the mulch will help you stretch out between waterings. When you change and start using 3 inches of mulch, yes, 3 inches of mulch on your plants, you will find that you don't need to water nearly so often. Plants that you had to water every third or fourth day may go a week very easily between waterings. That's certainly going to be helpful. But there are other things that mulch does too. I've seen those gardens in France and England because I love to travel. But when I come home, I have no interest in spending another month weeding. That's not my idea of fun at all. The mulch makes it so that I don't need to weed all the time. 3 inches of mulch means that very few weeds are going to come up. You can pull the ones that do come up very easily because they're wimpy and they have weak stems. You can do it just by bending over and jerking them out of the ground. Now, this does take a little work up front. If you have a half an acre of weeds right now, you have to get down to bare ground before you put the mulch on them. So you will need a hula hoe, and hopefully you can then rake up the stuff and make it go away because it's going to be old dry weeds full of weed seeds. If you're doing this in the early part of the year when those weeds are still green, those make great compost additions for your compost barrel. Now, once you've got the bare ground, either around your existing garden or starting from scratch, put down 3 inches of mulch. The mulch can be either organic or inorganic. I personally do not care much for putting down weed barrier underneath things. When I put down mulch, I put it on the bare ground. People who are insecure about that could put down 4 to 6 layers of newspaper, and that would be good. Whatever you do, don't put down black plastic. Don't let anybody talk you into putting plastic underneath your mulch, because the black plastic is going to tear and the edges are going to come up. Soon, within 2 or 3 years, you will have these lovely pieces of black plastic floating around your landscape. This is not something that most of us want to see. What is the mulch? You can get leftover tree prunings. You can get leaves that you've run through a shredder. You can go buy wonderful mulch at either the Sycamore or the Miramar landfill. You can use whatever you have for mulch. You can also do inorganic mulches. You can put down half-inch gravel. You can put down pea gravel. You can buy bark. There are so many choices that you can use. My favorite mulch of all time is called Gorilla Hair. Gorilla hair is redwood. It's the leftovers from when they mill the redwood. And so it binds together beautifully. It's kind of a rusty color, which is why it has the name gorilla hair. And it lasts a long time. It's great for use on slopes. Try it. You'll like it.
This is Janice Mork, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world.
Today I'm talking with James Pearson from Ember Art, founded in Jamul here in East County, now with offices in Ocean Beach and El Cajon. His company sells handmade jewelry that's beautiful and every color of the rainbow. They're called Aicholi beads, and there's a fascinating story behind them. How did you first discover these beads?
Yeah, good question. So I actually moved to Uganda in 2006 to work with a nonprofit. And through some friends, I met these women who were living in a slum just outside the capital. And they were working in a rock quarry, which in Uganda means sitting on the ground and pounding rocks with kind of a makeshift hammer for hours and hours every day. And they were just barely making enough to survive, about $1 a day. But on the side, they were making this beautiful jewelry. I saw that jewelry, and the only thing they were missing was a good market to sell it in. And so that was kind of how we first got involved with them.
Oh, wow. I can't imagine what those women must have been going through as they were working so long. How difficult was life for their families?
Oh, it was real difficult. So all the women that we're working with, they had to flee their homes in the north of Uganda because there was a 20-year-long civil war. And they had been moved into these really terrible displaced persons camps, and then they fled those two and ended up the only place they could find to live was this slum outside the capital. And the work that they're doing is just tremendously difficult. And to only make $1 a day, I mean, they've got kids to feed, they've got to provide shelter. It's a really tough life.
Oh no, that sounds terrible. So you noticed the unusual jewelry that they wore. These look like ceramic beads, each in multiple colors. So how are they made?
Yeah, good question. In fact, they're not ceramic at all. They're, believe it or not, they're all made from recycled paper. And so in Uganda, there's this marketplace where you can just buy kind of discarded paper from around the country. They go in there, they find these beautiful colors, and they'll cut a long strip and they'll hand roll every bead and then string it together into beautiful jewelry.
Wow, that sounds like a cool process. Then you offered to try and help them by bringing some jewelry back to the United States to sell these items. How did that work out, and where are they sold?
There were four women that we started working with, and I would go and kind of hand choose every piece of jewelry and give it to a friend who was coming back to America and say, hey, take this to my family. We just sold at, you know, farmers markets and crafts markets and things like this. And then we started approaching stores, at first kind of smaller gift shops and boutiques. But the last couple of years, we've been working with some larger chains like Whole Foods.
Wow, that's great that it's been so successful. Now, this is a fair trade company that you've started. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, fair trade is, it's just a way of thinking about business that says that everybody along the line, from the people who are initially producing something to even the consumer at the end, should be able to benefit and feel good about what they're doing. So we've worked really hard with the women in Uganda that we work with to say, what's a fair price for what you're selling us? And what else can we do to, you know, benefit your lives?
Now, where can people learn more about helping these women in Uganda? And where can they find Aicholi beads?
So our website, emberarts.com, it's emberarts.com, is a great place to learn more about it. We also have an online store there that people can purchase from. And we've got a map that shows all of the retailers that you can find our jewelry in.
Thank you for sharing your story with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1, the Network for Social Justice. You can also read our story and see photos of Aicholi beads at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Menashe, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection,
and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.